It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Wisconsin Assembly passed campaign finance bills yesterday. We'll talk to a guest who says this legislation will be good for the state.
First, today you can do more and more things without ever leaving the comfort of your own home. You can pretty much buy anything. You can work from home. You can meet with people across the globe, and the list goes on.
Well, how about going on an adventure, like a bike ride online? Might sound counterintuitive, but Eau Claire-based adventurer Jonathan Luthy is setting out to film his bike ride of the entire Chippewa Valley so anyone can explore it from anywhere.
Filming trips through nature has actually become popular, with videographers filming hours of footage from boats, from trains, and helicopters. Jonathan has actually previously filmed his kayak trip from Eau Claire to New Orleans. He's the founder and owner of Spin Vision, an interactive virtual marketing company. Jonathan, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, where did this idea come from of filming the entire Chippewa Valley?
Well, it started in real estate, but going back to that Mississippi trip, that's what really opened up my eyes to the possibilities of virtual tourism. And from there, I just saw opportunities all around me to help locals and tourists connect.
And what about that Mississippi trip?
Trip of a lifetime. So I left a career of 5 years to start this business and took 90 days off just to take a rest and polish up the business plan for Spin Vision. And it was during that trip that I really started to see the possibilities of virtual reality and just a way to share that with the world.
Well, now, this time around, you chose a bike as your mode of transportation. Why a bike?
Well, you know, I'm heavily inspired by what some of the larger companies in the world are doing, like Google Street View. They've also got a trike, and I thought adding a video component to the bike trails where viewers could sit back and watch and enjoy the trip while learning along the way would be a wonderful way to help promote our local area.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the learning along the way part. The little clip that I watched online is lovely, and it's strangely sort of soothing, too. You wouldn't expect that, but where does the learning come in?
Well, what we're working on is what I consider phase one, and right now it's just filming it. But what we're doing is we're creating interactive video. So if you can remember back to Volume 1, when they had pop-up video, there were little information bubbles that would tell you about the video you were watching. We're now doing that with an interactive component. So, for example, if you're in Eau Claire on our Eau Claire bike trail, we have a little winery right off of the trail. If you weren't from the area, you probably wouldn't know it. What we've done is we've worked on creating an interactive button that not only alerts you that it's there, but you can actually click on it and go inside and take a look.
And so you click on it, let's say a business is there, and you'll also film the inside of, say, a business?
Correct, yes.
Have businesses been cooperative with this? Are they interested in being part of this?
They are. It was, you know, tough in the beginning. It's so new, especially for Eau Claire. So what we did to kind of ease everybody into it was kind of the grocery store example of where they give you a free sample. So what we did is we created a local website called Tour Eau Claire, and we started donating a complimentary 360-degree image to every local restaurant and place of business, and those are the samples that we're using in the bike trail tour.
I want to talk a little bit about the gear that you've got. You're using, it sounds like a tricycle, not a little kid one, obviously, sort of an adult tricycle.
Correct.
What does your outfit look like?
Well, I actually bought a tricycle off of Craigslist for $150. But my camera is over 20 pounds, and it has some sophisticated motors that keep that camera balanced. Pretty expensive, and so what we had to do is we had to build a camera mount that is 8 feet above me to get the vantage point for a good view and to hold that camera securely and stable along the way.
I see. So this is why you're not using something like a GoPro, a helmet camera?
Correct. Just not the same.
Well, what does that afford you then, that more bird's eye? Not quite bird's eye, you're not up that high, but what do you get to see from that point of view?
Well, you just get to see a little bit further down the trail. If you were on a tricycle, we've tested that vantage point. You just really could not see all of the surrounding area. It was more of just the path in front of you. So by using a bigger camera rig other than a GoPro, we can actually use different lenses that are a little bit wider. And from that elevation, we can just see a little bit better in all directions.
We're talking to Jonathan Luthy right now, founder and owner of Spin Vision, an interactive virtual marketing company, and he's filming his bike trip through the entire Chippewa Valley here in Wisconsin. And I imagine some people would wonder why anybody would spend so much time just watching someone else on their bike ride or watching what they would see, who do you think is going to watch this thing and benefit the most?
You know, one of the neatest things was shortly after publishing the entire 90-minute segment that we've currently got, I was contacted by an elderly woman who just wanted to reach out and thank me for the opportunity because it was an adventure she couldn't do on her own. Just over the weekend, I was contacted by another elderly individual who said that for the last 3 days, she spent 30 minutes a day watching different segments just to get out and see things that she couldn't do on her own.
Hmm. Did you foresee that you might be getting people like that who couldn't get out of the house anymore?
You know, not at first, but as this company has grown, we started to help a number of different businesses, and one of them is a local assisted living home. And I was talking with their activities director, thinking outside of the box, and we came up with some neat ideas on how we could help their residents take virtual day trips. For example, 2 years ago, I went up to the Apostle Islands ice caves and actually captured over 50 360-degree panoramas that you can view as if you're standing right there. Their residents aren't able to get up there, and it is such a limited opportunity to see the ice caves. We captured it for the world to see.
Hmm. How much of it have you gotten filmed so far?
Say that one more time.
How much have you filmed so far of the bike trail?
Yeah, so we filmed about 10 miles from the heart of Eau Claire and 10 miles out of town and then back. The goal is to create segments going both directions. So as you reach forks in the road, you will actually be able to interact and actually click to go back the way you came from a different perspective.
Now, you talked earlier about people sort of having adventures vicariously through you, through watching this. Have you had any adventures on these trips that you've left in, that you did not edit out?
You know, when I was one of the newest projects we're working on, which is very exciting, is in the education sector. There is a 400-acre nature center here in town. It's called Beaver Creek Reserve. And doing the trail tours and interactive virtual tours, we got to see some pretty neat acts of nature. We had some animals watch us. It's just, you can really capture some of the beauty while doing this. And so that's kind of neat. We're going to be adding that so people can really get an experience of what it's like to be out in nature at Beaver Creek Reserve.
Well, and speaking of nature, we've got winter coming on. Are you only going to film in the summertime, or do you think you'll get some winter shots?
The long-term goal is to actually do it in all four seasons. Here in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, we have some beautiful seasons. We're hoping to capture that because there are so many different things to do throughout the year.
And so you've got this bike trip that you're going to be filming, and you were inspired by a canoe trip on the Mississippi. What's next for you?
Well, recently bought a snowmobile. So if we get some snow this year, I've actually got a camera mount that we're looking to mount and to do the trail tours of the snowmobile trails.
So that's more of a thrill ride for people.
A little bit.
And how can we keep track of your journey online?
Well, the most current stuff is always being shared on Facebook. Just because we're constantly producing content. But our main website, spinvision.com, is a wonderful place to see a little bit about what we do, and then we can help you connect with some of the other activities we've been up to.
Now, you're a native to the area, but are you learning new stuff about the place where you live?
Absolutely. You know, we have hidden gems in our backyard, and so that's really one of the goals. And the Eau Claire area seems to be growing rapidly, and it's just such a wonderful way to share my experience growing up here. But along the way, I'm really getting to see some neat places of my own.
Jonathan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
That was Jonathan Luthy, founder and owner of Spin Vision, an interactive virtual marketing company. He's filming his bike trip through the entire Chippewa Valley.
The Wisconsin Assembly approved bills yesterday that would overhaul the state's campaign finance laws and the Government Accountability Board, which oversees elections and ethics in Wisconsin. The Assembly approved these bills after adopting modifications the Senate made earlier this month.
Democrats argue this legislation would open the door for corruption and expand the influence of money in politics. Other critics say these bills break from Wisconsin's tradition of transparency in government.
But our next guest says these campaign finance bills are good for Wisconsin. Eric Wang joins us now. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Competitive Politics and a campaign finance attorney for Wiley Rhine. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, in a recent opinion piece you wrote, Eric, you say we shouldn't fear campaign finance reform, and to not fear it, we need to understand how we got here. So how did we get here?
Yeah, well, you know, I think the latest bill that the legislature passed and the governor is presumed that he'll sign that bill. You know, I think it's a positive development for the state of Wisconsin. After the catastrophe we saw with the John Doe investigations that your listeners may have heard about, in which prosecutors went after 29 citizen groups under a theory that they just sort of made up, and which the Wisconsin Supreme Court said there was no basis in the law whatsoever for that investigation. And as a result of that, seems to be the catalyst for the legislation that just passed, which really will rein in the ability of law enforcement officials and state officials to regulate political speech and to regulate citizens' First Amendment rights. And this legislation would impose, you know, bright line standards for when citizen speech can be regulated and when it's off limits to state regulators.
The theory you were talking about was centered around the idea of coordination between campaigns and outside advocacy groups. The prosecutors said it wasn't a made up interpretation, but an interpretation of a law that some people said vague. But it was kind of a common understanding for a while that there was a bright line. Candidates shouldn't coordinate with outside groups.
Well, I mean, I don't know if there was an understanding or not about that, but it's just not really a tenable position that the prosecutors took, given that, you know, whether it's in Wisconsin or in other states or at the federal level, I think there's an expectation or an understanding in the opposite direction that state legislators may talk to citizen advocacy groups about the issues they care about. For example, abortion rights groups will obviously want to talk to legislators who are sympathetic to their cause about that issue. Pro-life groups will want to talk to pro-life legislators. Gun control groups or pro-Second Amendment groups will naturally want to talk to legislators about their issues that they care about, and they're of course permitted to do so under the First Amendment. That's the very essence of democracy. And when state legislators and those interest groups want to coordinate with regards to public education campaigns or public awareness campaigns about those issues, they should, of course, be entitled to do so, and they are under the U.S. Constitution and the First Amendment. And so what, the theory that the prosecutors went after these groups in the John Doe investigation under was that, these groups were putting out public messages urging the public to support the budget reform bill that Governor Walker had proposed a few years ago. And that was the theory that the prosecutors went after them under, that, it was somehow prohibited for those groups to talk to agents of Governor Walker about supporting his legislative agenda.
So the new laws clarify what candidates, campaigns can do coordinating with issue groups versus actual express election advocacy. So as I understand it now, there is more of a bright line still between candidates and a group that runs ads mostly saying vote for or vote against candidate X. Do you think it's good to have that barrier in place still?
Yes, I mean, I think it's absolutely essential that there has to be a bright line separation, because otherwise, anytime a citizen or an advocacy group talks to an elected official or talks to somebody, a state policymaker, they're in danger of potentially being subject to investigation and potentially having any of their speech-related activities in regards to those issues being the subject of regulation. And, they'll never, without that bright line, they'll never know whether or not their speech is going to be regulated or not. And as a result of that, it really creates a chilling effect where people just don't speak. They're forced into silence because of this sort of Damocles of the campaign finance law hanging over their heads.
Talking to attorney Eric Wang about campaign finance changes on their way, it looks like, to the governor's desk here in Wisconsin. He says they're good for Wisconsin, good for free speech in the state. So, Eric, where people worry is you know, it's not so much just talking to politicians, but running an ad before election time saying candidate X, I don't know, is opposed to freedom or something like that. They're doing bad things. And then instead of ending vote for or against, they just say call and tell the candidate you don't like it. It seems like kind of splitting hairs to say that's not an election message to some people, to some critics of this change.
Well, I mean, you know, I could see where they're coming from, but at the same time, it's really impossible to, you know, legislate, you know, that sort of distinction between issue advocacy and election advocacy. Many jurisdictions have tried writing statutes. Most of them have not been very satisfactory, whether from a practical standpoint or from a legal standpoint, and many of those laws have been struck down. And I could tell you as a practitioner, it's very difficult for us and for our clients to grapple with laws where they've tried to sort of erase the bright line distinction and try to regulate issue advocacy speech as election advocacy. As I said before, one point that I think is crucial is that, you know, during the time of elections, that's the time when the public is tuning in most to what people are talking about with respect to elected officials. And so that's naturally the opportune time for when these issue groups also want to raise awareness about their legislative issues. So if you're, pro-abortion rights group or a pro-life group, or, you know, pick any other type of issue that you're interested in, that's the election season is the time when you want to bring attention to those issues. And it's also the time, whether it's, you know, the attention of the public or whether it's the attention of the elected officials that you want to, attract. And so it's natural that issue groups will want to speak out about politicians and their positions on the issues during elections. And to the extent that they're not, trying to influence the elections, to the extent that they're trying to influence, the public debate on their issues and to influence elected officials and elected officials' positions on those issues, they should be permitted to do so without being subject to the machinery of campaign finance laws.
Another issue that comes up and that may change here is disclosure of donations. So there's three different places somebody could give money to: a candidate directly, generally disclosed,
right.
An express group, the one that says vote for or vote against, that I think is still disclosed. Then the third one, the issue group, not disclose. And people are worried that under this system, you can donate your money to that last group, the one that doesn't say vote for, doesn't have to disclose who donates, then they can coordinate with the campaign and run lots of ads that name names of candidates, but just don't say vote for or against. Is this going to open the door to a lot of money and we don't know where it's coming from?
You know, I don't think so. The problem with disclosure to the last group that you mentioned, the issue groups, is that, you know, the donors who give to those groups, a lot of those groups, can be quite controversial. If you're a pro-abortion rights group, there's still a lot of threats and violence directed at, you know, pro-choice groups and their supporters. 10, 15 years ago, if you had given to a group advocating for gay rights, it's very likely that you would have suffered repercussions if your identity became public. So, people who give to issue advocacy groups, it's not part of the bargain for them to have their names and identities disclosed if they want to support controversial issues. And, that's how, social change gets enacted in our country, is that, these groups are able to get the resources that they need to advocate for causes that, used to be considered controversial, for positions that used to be very socially unpopular. It's because of that anonymity that's been afforded to the donors of those groups that they've been able to, accomplish many of the things that they've been able to do over the past, few years, over the past decade.
Another concern that gets raised, Eric, is that, say, if I was running for office, your law firm donated to an issue group that said sympathetic things about me, didn't disclose that. I knew you made the donation, is there a risk of corruption, or at least the appearance of corruption, that I might say, hey, yeah, I want to work for these guys when I'm in office?
Well, you know, I mean, there are still bribery laws in place. And so if you have that sort of quid pro quo agreement that, you know, this interest group or this entity or this contributor is making these contributions with the understanding that it's to help a specific candidate or elected official, and there is a understanding that that candidate or elected official is going to take official action as a result of that transaction, that's prohibited under the bribery laws. That's a criminal offense, and that's a serious offense. And, you know, I don't think that most candidates, elected officials, and, you know, most of my clients, any of my clients would want to be involved in a transaction like that. So, no, I mean, I think there's sufficient, there are still sufficient safeguards in place to prevent that type of corruption.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right, well, thank you.
That's Eric Wang. He's senior fellow at the Center for Competitive Politics and a campaign finance attorney for the firm Wiley Ryan, with us to make the case for campaign finance bills just passed in the assembly being good for Wisconsin. The issue of refugees has been cast in a new political light after Friday's attacks on Paris. Over the weekends, reports emerged that a gunman involved in the attacks may have entered Europe among thousands of refugees fleeing Syria. Now, Governor Scott Walker and other Wisconsin Republicans are saying they oppose the idea of Syrian refugees settling in the Badger State due to security concerns. Here's a clip of House Speaker Paul Ryan from Wisconsin making the case for slowing down on taking in refugees.
We have a refugee situation that we think requires a pause and a more comprehensive assessment on how to better guarantee that members of ISIS are not infiltrating themselves among the refugee population.
Jason Stein joins us now for a rundown on what politicians from Wisconsin are saying about accepting Syrian refugees. He's a state capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Jason, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thank you, Veronica.
Well, Governor Walker has joined the ranks of other governors who say that they don't want to accept Syrian refugees in their states. What did Governor Walker say?
I mean, concretely, he said that he would do everything in his power to try and prevent Syrian refugees from being settled in Wisconsin, you know, including denying, you know, certain aid from the state to those refugees.
Now, Governor Walker has joined almost half the governors in the country on this issue. Here's North Carolina's Governor Pat McCrory about refugees.
I care for these people, but what worries me is some of these people could it actually be ISIS coming into our country, and we didn't take every precaution to make sure that our federal government is checking into these people.
And does that sort of typify what we're hearing right now, Jason, from these governors who are saying no to Syrian refugees?
I believe so. I mean, it's overwhelmingly being voiced as a security concern on the part of those governors.
So now getting to saying no, can a governor, can a state actually say no, refugees cannot settle here? Do they have that power?
Not to my knowledge. I have asked Governor Walker's office to clarify what legal authority they might have to deny a residency to a refugee, and I haven't yet gotten a response from them. It's worth noting that if the federal government authorizes the refugees, my understanding is that they would come as they would get a visa and they'd be a permanent legal resident in the United States with the ability to work with work privileges. So, you know, just as, you know, if you and I, Veronica, were going to move down to Illinois, we wouldn't necessarily seek Governor Rauner's permission to do that. I have not yet seen anything that would suggest that these immigrants would be on a different legal footing.
So considering there's a lot of unknowns here, a lot of people saying no, that the states don't have the power to say no to refugees, what is sort of the political perspective of making these public statements?
Well, I think what the significance is that there is a debate, a more on-point debate at the federal level taking place about do you grant refugee status and accept these larger numbers of Syrian immigrants. And, you know, federal officials have pointed to statements by governors as one factor that they should take into account. Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, for instance, cited the statements from governors as one reason why he wanted to see caution from other federal officials on this.
We're talking with Jason Stein right now from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's joining us to talk about what Wisconsin lawmakers are saying about accepting Syrian refugees. Now, the refugee crisis goes back to well before the Paris attacks. Are there, in fact, Syrian refugees in Wisconsin already?
If there are, they would be, you know, it would be a handful. You know, I've spoken with one social service agency in Milwaukee that frequently helps settle refugees from around the world in Wisconsin and upper Michigan, and they have not worked with anyone, settled any Syrian refugees in Wisconsin so far. But of course, you know, it's also possible for refugees to be settled in one place and move to another.
We were talking about how at the federal level, the federal government is processing these statements by governors who say they don't want to take Syrian refugees. Do we know how the president is responding to these sorts of statements?
He made remarks in Turkey yesterday that were, I would say, a full-throated defense of accepting Syrian refugees. The argument being made by the Obama administration is that there is for, you know, Syrian refugees and really for any other refugee, a very extensive process that takes place that can take a year, 18 months, even longer, in which there is, you know, background checks being done. You know, one argument that's being made on the other side is that given the chaotic situation in Syria, you know, that background check process may not be as accomplished. It may not be as accomplished as easily as if, you know, from another developed country you had someone seeking refugee status.
Jason, do you know what that vetting process would look like from the side of the United States?
Right. Well, I mean, I am a state government reporter. I don't want to inflate my knowledge of this process, but it does involve someone going, you know, a refugee, a prospective refugee going to the United Nations, seeking that refugee status, being allocated to a potential host country like the United States, and then, you know, that host country, you know, certainly in our case, would go through, you know, an extensive series of checks. It would include security checks to make sure that the person is who, in fact, they say they are, that they have a legitimate claim to refugee status, as opposed to perhaps simply coming from an impoverished part of the world where a ticket to the United States would be a great boon, and that the person doesn't, you know, pose a risk to the people of the United States. And I'm not saying that the process is perfect. I don't know a lot about it, to be honest with you, but, you know, advocates for the refugees are saying that the system is already in place.
Now back to the state legislature. Governor Walker has said Wisconsin would say no to Syrian refugees. Ron Johnson is saying something similar. What about other Republicans in Wisconsin State House?
Right. I mean, I think Ron Johnson has said today that he would also back hitting the pause button on it. Although he said it might restart quickly. Yesterday, Ron Johnson said that he favored prioritizing Syrian refugees, such as women and children that might be identified as being both the most vulnerable and the least potential risk. So I would say that Senator Johnson's comments have been, although skeptical of refugees, have not equated to a flat-out refusal in the way that Governor Walker has.
And anything else from Republicans at the Capitol? Or Democrats?
Yes, there was actually really only a matter of hours before the attacks in Paris, there was a proposal put forward largely by Democrats in the state assembly that would direct state officials to seek federal grants to locate roughly 900 Syrian immigrants in the United States, in Wisconsin as a humanitarian measure. The Speaker of the Wisconsin Assembly, Robin Voss, has said that that proposal is going nowhere in his house.
Well, Jason, thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Veronica.
That was Jason Stein, State Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to talk about what Wisconsin lawmakers are saying about accepting Syrian refugees.
We were just talking to reporter Jason Stein about what Wisconsin lawmakers are saying about accepting refugees from Syria. It's been reported that one of the perpetrators of the attacks in Paris may have been a Syrian who entered Europe with refugees via Greece.
Now we speak with an expert on the global refugee situation as the West debates how to handle the ongoing crisis.
We're taking your calls now at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about refugees and refugee status? Do you think the U.S. should accept refugees from Syria? Why? Why not? Call 800-642-1234. 642-1234 or share your thoughts and questions on the Central Time Facebook page.
Shailja Sharma joins us now. She's the director of Refugee and Forced Migration Studies at DePaul University. Shailja, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, according to the United Nations, what is the definition of a refugee?
So according to the United Nations Convention, which was signed in 1951, a refugee is a person who has a well-founded fear of persecution by virtue of belonging to a race, a nationality, a sect, or because of political opinion. And this person has to be outside the borders of his or her own state.
And in terms of the difference between migrants, refugees, and asylum seekers, how do you sort all that out?
So migrants is a sort of catch-all category. You know, anybody who moves from their place of origin is a migrant. A refugee is a person which has a definition that has a very strict legal meaning. And the legal meaning is somebody, as I said, who suffers from a well-founded fear of persecution and is outside the country of his or her origin. An asylum seeker is somebody who appeals to a country for refuge. So it's really an interim kind of status. You're an asylum seeker when you apply to get the legal designation of being a refugee. So an asylum seeker is somebody who appeals for refuge. Once that person is granted refuge by the country that they appeal to, they become a refugee. And they are covered with all the sort of legal protections of the term refugee.
So Shailja, are we in general using the term correctly when we refer to Syrian refugees in this case?
Yes. I mean, they are refugees because they have a well-founded fear of persecution and they are outside their country of origin. But technically, when they enter Germany or Sweden or the U.S., they are technically asylum seekers. And they become refugees once they are granted refugee status by, say, the United States or Sweden or Germany. Then they become refugees.
Now, earlier in our last segment with Jason Stein from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, we talked about how refugees who arrive in the United States may have a visa, permanent legal status, and the right to work here. What does that mean for their movement throughout the United States as we look at some of the states who say they would not be welcoming to refugees?
Well, technically, when they first arrive, there are a number of organizations that help them settle in. The federal government decides where they go. So this is not in the hands of state governments. You know, the federal government might decide in the interest of political, you know, peace and quiet to not send them to places they're not welcome at. But technically, this is not something that the states handle. What happens in Illinois, for example, is that refugees are sent here and then a lot of local agencies get together and help, you know, receive the refugee, find some place where they can stay and set them up, process their papers so they can start getting some of the help that they need to initially settle in. And then after that goes for about 90 days. And after that, they're on their own. So the state doesn't really suffer the burden of refugees economically that much.
Do countries have a specific legal obligation to accept refugees?
Yes. So in 1951, after the Second World War, a number of countries were signatories to what's called the 1951 Convention and 1967 Protocol that defines what a refugee is and what the world owes in terms of protecting these very vulnerable populations. And the U.S. is one of the original signatories to this document. So we are obliged to, you know, grant refuge to people who fulfill the definition of a refugee. And the United States, you know, last year accepted about 90,000 refugees. So obviously we do a pretty good job of that.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Edward on the line first from La Crosse. Edward, hello.
Hello. Yes, I don't think we should accept any refugees because there's a lot of angst among the population. And President Obama always said we should have a conversation about stuff, but I'm sure he won't on this issue. And our veterans need money. The homeless need money. The colleges are begging for money. And all these refugees, which now, by her definition, could go into the tens of hundreds of millions. So the law is kind of outdated. And these people can easily get $30,000, $50,000 each in benefits. And so we just need to rest, take a pause, and let the immigrants, refugees, kind of absorb into the population so each area doesn't get overwhelmed.
Edward, I just want to ask you quickly. The first thing you said was there was a lot of angst. What did you mean by that?
You know, if you let in so many of these Syrian refugees, like to say if you even have a couple hundred that are favorable to ISIS and wanting destroyed, that is a terrible situation. And I imagine the vetting process will be just as weak as letting immigrants in from our southern borders.
Edward, thank you so much for that call. And a lot of questions there. But Shyla, does the United States have the capacity to absorb the numbers of immigrants that may be asking?
The United States, according to the statistics I have from the UNHCR, last year accepted 331 Syrian refugees. This is compared to about 94,000 that were accepted by Germany and over 2 million that were accepted by Turkey. So the United States is already accepting a fraction of a fraction of Syrian refugees in the world. Secondly, we do not give them tens of thousands of dollars each. An average refugee in Illinois gets $1,200 for 90 days, and that's the extent of the money we pay them. So I think, you know, the fears of sort of them being an economic drain on our society are highly overrated. The second thing I will say is that all refugees who come from Syria go through three levels of security checking before they're admitted to the United States. They are, their stories are first checked by the UN, then by the Department of Homeland Security, and then if need be, by other agencies at the federal level. And only if they pass the security checks, then they become eligible for being rehoused in the U.S. And it's a long process. It takes 18 months to 2 years. So we're not going to be flooded by Syrian refugees. I think part of the hysteria we are seeing here around Syrian refugees is, you know, as a result of all these 19 Republican governors saying, 20 Republican governors saying they don't want to accept refugees. And that's, you know, very much sort of political opportunism. None of these state governors are being flooded by Syrian refugees and are not likely to do so in the near future.
Let's go back to our callers now. We've got Isaiah with us next and Locke de Flambeau. Isaiah, hello.
Hi. As an American Indian, I think it's so ironic that our country was founded on welcoming refugees. We welcomed Europeans from Europe, and now it's these same Europeans oftentimes who don't want other refugees. It's like it's good enough for me, but not good enough for anybody else. And I just think that that's wrong.
Isaiah, thank you for that call. And Shyla, what do you say to that?
Well, I think that, you know, European, we did accept European refugees, but we weren't so welcoming to European Jews during World War II. So we have a mixed record of accepting people. In 1939, the most infamous case is that of the SS St. Louis, which came with about 1,000 German Jews on board, and we turned that ship away. Polls taken in 1939 showed very clearly that about 80% of Americans thought that was the right thing to do. So, you know, yes, we are built on immigration and we are built on refugees, but we have not been uniformly welcoming of refugees.
And Jay, as I appreciate that call, and next we're going to go to Mark in Milwaukee. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I think that, you know, that I've heard at the start of this whole refugee problem, we had that boy, the picture of that boy that boy's body that washed up in the Mediterranean, and there were calls to let in millions of refugees from various humanitarian groups. And Obama administration pushed back and said, no, we're going to take a limited amount. And now with the terrorist attacks in France, we've had a call to have no refugees allowed in. Mm-hmm. And again, the Obama administration has pushed back and said, no, we're going to take this limited amount. Mm-hmm. The administration is walking a fine line. It would be good if we could accept more and allow in a percentage more commensurate with our ability to absorb refugees. But I understand that the administration has made their choice, and I think they've made a wise one.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Mark. Shyla, what do you say?
Mm-hmm. I think that's absolutely correct. The government is not going to change their admission policies towards refugees at every twist and turn in the political, fate of other nations. The fact of the matter is that Syrian refugees, for the most part, are highly educated. A lot of them are fluent in English, and they bring skills which our country needs. It's in the interest of our country to accept them and to use them as we have, appreciated the skills of migrants and refugees through the ages. I think unless it's proved that Syrian refugees bring with them, you know, affiliations to ISIS or to terrorism and so on, and even if they do, our job is to, you know, treat those terrorists like criminals and punish them as they need to be punished, while at the same time honoring our humanitarian commitments.
And Shailja, just very briefly before we let you go, how does this refugee crisis in Syria compare to other historic refugee crises?
The numbers suggest that it's the largest refugee crisis since World War II. And the reason is that the Middle East right now is an extremely unstable place. There are a number of countries which, because of a combination of factors, of civil war, of war, of, domestic instability, regime change, all of those things, is in chaos. And the Syrian example is just the most long drawn out and most violent of all of these crises. So we are seeing a significant influx of people from Syria, Afghanistan, and Eritrea, which is a longer term crisis. And unless things change significantly in Syria, which I hope, you know, the Paris attacks are a wake-up call with that regard.
And I'm sorry, we have to leave it there. That was Shailja Sharma, Director of Refugee and Forced Migration Studies at DePaul University.